This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva with another installment in our Jews, Judaism, and Modernity course of Jewish history at webyeshiva.org. Good evening, everyone. Let me just hit the recorder. Sorry about any of that technical problem getting going. I feel like it's been a while since we met. Last week, of course, was Shavuot, and the week before we didn't meet, also for technical problems. Sorry about that. So we are continuing when we last left off, which seems like quite a while ago. Napoleon had met his defeat, or at least his penultimate defeat. We'll see. He snuck back in. And from November of 1814 till June of 1815, quite a number of months, the Congress of Vienna was convened in Vienna by a group of European states. The four main players at the Congress were France, Austria, Russia, and Britain. And the agenda of this conference, portrayed here in this painting, which the painting takes place afterwards, and of course is something of a historical fiction, like all great paintings that depict scenes like this of everyone together. You know, like the well-known painting of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which hangs, I think, in Boston, and which actually was on the back side of the $2 bill that was around when I was a kid. I don't know if they still have $2 bills. These paintings are all historical fictions. The scene never actually took place. One of the interesting things about the Congress of Vienna is that it wasn't didn't function actually like a congress, meaning a group of people getting together to participate in debating and deliberating and voting on things. But most of the work of the Congress takes place in committee sessions and in backroom negotiations and in the streets and coffee houses of Vienna, where these four powers, although there were representatives, of course, of all of the European nations, but France, Austria, Russia, and Britain get together to map out the future of Europe after about 25 years of war. In May of 1814, Napoleon had surrendered, and that ended about 25 years of war and revolution throughout Europe, and the Congress had to figure out how to redraw the map of Europe. Now, that interactive map that I sent you, if you didn't look at it, really, it's really worthwhile taking a look at. That was part of the problem in the in our session 2 weeks ago. I, by accident, put the link in the wrong place in setting up the shear, so that when people tried to log on, you were sent to that website. So I apologize for that. But if you were sent to that website, then you saw that kind of animated map of, you know, what had happened to Europe and how it was reorganized and restructured to look something like the Europe we recognize today. Or at least much more closely approximating the Europe that we recognize today. The dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire. There's the link. At the bottom of this map, there's a link to the interactive map. I'm not sure that you can cut and paste from the screen, but you can type it in, or you can go to our Shear's homepage, to one of the emails that I sent you, to see the animated. I don't know why they call it interactive. It's not interactive. You don't interact with it. You're passive, but you get to see an animated presentation of how the map of Europe was was redrawn. Somebody in the chat mentions that this sounds something like the EU. It also sounds something like the UN. And one of the interesting things was one of the interesting things in the Congress was the inclusion of France, the defeated nation, in the negotiations for how we were going to for how we were going to redraw the map of Europe, that the conquered nation is involved in the process of of redrawing the map. But Chaim asked what this little white section at the eastern edge of the Black Sea is. I'm not sure. It's next to Crimea. But you can look on a more modern map to see what area that corresponds to. The right, but I'm not sure what Cherkessus means, or what that is exactly, or what that is today. The efforts to deal with the reestablishing of Europe dealt with a wide array of topics. The Jewish question at the Congress of Vienna was a very, very, very small topic in a larger set of deliberations. What we're going to do tonight is one of those kind of tricky things when examining Jewish history. Jewish history, if studied properly, of course, takes into account larger trends in general world history. That's a lot of what we've done the past number of sessions. But there's always the problem that when looking at the macro through the prism of the micro, you tend to distort things. And I just want to make that disclaimer at the beginning. When we're talking about the Jewish question at the Congress of Vienna, if you were to read a book about the Congress of Vienna, and there are quite a few good books about the Congress of Vienna. As a matter of fact, Henry Kissinger, wrote, I think, his doctoral dissertation, and which was later turned into a book, about the Congress of Vienna and how it created modern Europe. If you were even just reading an encyclopedia article on the Congress of Vienna, if you look through the Wikipedia article on the Congress of Vienna, you're not going to see anything about Jews or Judaism. It was a very, very, very minor topic in the larger discussion of the future of Europe. But for our purposes, it was, of course, an important topic. But it's important not to think. In other words, one could walk away from a discussion on this topic that we're going to have tonight with the impression that this was all these folks were dealing with at the Congress of Vienna that went on for whatever it was, 8 months or so. This was not, of course, the case. But for our purposes, it's significant. One of the things that the Congress was criticized for was a kind of return to, like, an old-fashioned a type of conservativeness, where the balance between the civil rights and the liberties and freedoms that were advanced through the French Revolution, inspired by the American Revolution, that those were turned back, and those were de-emphasized, and those there was a certain rollback on some of those things after the Congress, because the Congress was largely interested in fostering a type of stability, political stability, that had to be balanced against some of those more radical. I mean, it's funny for us to think of them as radical, but some of those more radical elements that did upset a lot of the ancien regime, the way things had always been, the status quo. So the Congress of Vienna turns that back. So when we talk about, a few times we use the expression in the past about letting the genie out of the bottle, well, a little bit you can try to shove him back in here or there, or you can try to cover him up with a rug, I've already mixed a few metaphors, and that's a little bit about what you see after the Congress of Vienna. Let me just pause here to look at some of these chats. Okay. Wait, so somebody who's, while we're talking, people are doing this research about the Eastern Black Sea. Can somebody fill us in on what that's about? Joel, can you, I'm going to open your mic. What is that place?
Because the Cherkasy Oblast is at Dnieper River, so I mistakenly applied it to the Cherkasy Oblast. But it's Karachi Cherkasy for sure.
Okay, so Barbara, you're up. What have you learned about this question? Do you have a microphone, Barbara? No. Okay. You'll have to. Oh, I see. You've cut and pasted. No, so, but in other words, all of this that you're sending us, this is much later. It's from the 20th century. This map is from 1815. What was that area in 1815? And was it autonomous then? That's the question. No, but so the stuff from Barbara's link doesn't answer our question because it's all 20th century. All right, so we'll come back to it. Chaim, it was your question. You'll have to do the homework. What I'd like to do tonight, I'm not sure if people had a chance to look over the material beforehand and to think about some of the questions that I proposed. These are the resolutions. These are the resolutions that were put forth over the course of the Congress of Vienna, and they deal with this question of, what are we going to do with the Jews? Remember, as Napoleon advanced throughout Europe, he spread with him, for whatever his motivations were, and we discussed that a little bit, he spread with him this notion of liberty, equality, fraternity, that all of the folks in the nation were entitled to civil rights, and that included the Jews. And we saw the emancipation of the Jewish people and the granting of civil rights and citizenship to the Jews wherever he went. The question was, now that we're trying to return to what was before, what are we going to do with the Jews? So take a minute to yourself. Look here on the board and look at the first two resolutions, the Prussian resolution and the Austrian resolution. Think for a moment. Don't do anything. Don't write on the chat. You can write in your notebook if you want. Let me open the notebook. But what are the differences between these first two resolutions? It's a very subtle difference. But what are the differences between these first two resolutions? Take a moment and look at it. could take another moment to look through those, to look at those first two resolutions, and try to understand what's going on here. What are the differences? I mean, you can look carefully. Okay, I ask, please don't write in the chat. Please don't write in the chat. Just please consider this to yourself. Okay, if you want to write it down, you can write it down in the note section. Okay, if you think you have something, ignoring what was already posted, if you want, you can chat to me directly. Okay, Esther.
The difference between one and two is the first one says that provided they fulfill all their civil obligations, the second one is to the extent that they assume all their civil obligations.
Okay, mean and spell that out for me.
You could assume your obligations, but that doesn't mean that you're going to fulfill them.
Oh, okay. Which of these two is pardon the expression, is good for the Jews, is better for the Jews?
The second one.
Okay, because? Well,
obligations are. And Humboldt says that they are not political obligations, political rights.
Okay.
So I am not sure all the time what civil obligations are in that context.
Well, there is one difference that you might think the Prussian is better. The Prussian The Prussian resolution talks about giving equivalent civil rights to the Jews, that the Jews should be on an equal footing to the Christians, right? But obviously it's conditional that they fulfill all of their civil obligations, meaning if the Jews will accept upon themselves the civil obligations, they should be entitled to receive equal civil rights. The second resolution talks about an eligibility to obtain civil rights, which are then commensurate to the extent that they assume all civil obligations. Meaning, I think probably the second resolution is inferior to the first. The first says, in other words, if you, Jews, will accept upon yourselves your civil obligations, all of your civil obligations, obviously, so then you're entitled to equal rights just like everyone else. The Austrian resolution is already starting to try to peel back the granting of those rights to obtain civil rights, but not equality. Let me just look at what some other things have come up in the... Uh, Right, to vote, pay taxes, certainly to pay taxes, military service. What rights Austria thought Germany
Right to serve in Parliament, was that a right?
that was not a was that a right? I it might have been, yes. It might have been. I'm not certain. Okay. Now let's look a little further ahead. There were objections to these ideas. There were objections to these ideas. Right, Humboldt, who we'll encounter again before the night is done, mentions this idea that if they're eligible for rights, then we're obliged to grant them their rights. That's a pretty liberal and far-reaching statement. One second. Let me get rid of that scribble. That's much better. There are objections to these declarations. Bavaria, for example, opposes the Austrian resolution and says that this is altogether a matter not to be discussed at the Congress, but for each individual nation to decide for itself. They're trying to table the whole discussion away from some kind of binding resolution on all the signatories of the convention. Also the Hanseatic League, which was a collection of little city-states. Here, the Holstein resolution further tries to water it down. As long as they fulfill all of a citizen's duties to his country, the Jew will be guaranteed established civil justice. So, for example, look at the first Holstein resolution. And the second. Compare these two. Which is preferred? Again, look at them, read them carefully to yourself. Again, there's a very, very, very subtle difference between them. Do not post your thoughts to the chat. You can post them to me privately. What's the distinction between them, and what's the practical difference between them? Okay, take another moment. again, to examine between Holstein Resolution 1 and Holstein Resolution 2. When you think you've found a nafgamina between them, drop me an email. Drop me a chat privately to me. The person that pointed out that resolution number one gives quote unquote civil justice, what does that mean, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? Okay, again, people are posting to all participants. In the chat box, it says send to. You can choose send to presenter. That's me. Send only to me, not to all participants. So that's the point of this. I'm trying to get everybody to think on their own without the benefit of hearing what everybody else has to say yet. Okay. So, on the participants panel, by a show of hands, raise your hand if you think that resolution number one is preferable. Okay. By a show of hands. I mean, take down your hand, Rafi and Sherry. By a show of hands, show me if you think resolution number two is preferable. Okay, so Rafi and Sherry voted for number one. And nobody else voted. There were only two choices. So I'll ask Sherry to pass you the mic. Sherry, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead. So you have the mic. Explain.
Number two, even if the Jews do everything, you are the way I heard.
Right. In other words, the number one promises established civil justice, but in other words, right. But in other words, number one establishes grants established civil justice, which is not the same as saying equal rights. But in other words, number two seems good because it talks about protecting them from persecution and pressure and all these other things, but that's not, that's a little slippery because it doesn't, it doesn't, it seems humanitarian, but to say that you'll be protected from persecution does not in any way guarantee any kind of rights. The distinction the distinction is really very fine between them. And that really I think underlines some of the very delicate negotiations amongst the parties, and you can see how just the change of a word or two, the change of a word or two can mean the difference between everything. The last, yeah, go ahead. Civil justice, right? Meaning, right. Right. So in other words, number one is not, in other words, number one is not saying that you, if you do, if you fulfill all of your obligations, you'll be given equality. It's that your protection is dependent upon your fulfilling all of your obligations. So if you don't fulfill all of your obligations, you're not even given like the minimum basic. The minimum basic protection. Look at the final two on the next page here. These two again. I'll just ask you one more time to one more time to do this little experiment of thinking it through, posting only to me your thoughts. The difference between the final resolution, which is here number six, and the penultimate resolution. The two versions are virtually identical. Are virtually identical. What's the difference between them? And what's lost or gained between the final draft and the ultimate final resolution between number five and number six? Read through it very carefully. What's the difference between them? Again, I'm asking you to like read it like a diplomat, reading it like a lawyer to find these ever to split the hairs, as it were. Okay, so a few people picked up on a few different things, but I think the significant difference here is in a very, very small word. It's in a very small word. A few, I guess last year, maybe it was 2 years ago, there was an exhibit at the. Oh, it must have been 2 years ago. It was around the time of the 60th anniversary of Medinat Yisrael, the 60th Yom HaAtzmaut. There was an exhibit at the Israel Museum where they had 60 famous or significant or important documents from the National Archives on display, as opposed to the United States, where the National Archives has this very majestic home in Washington, D.C., and you can go there on a class trip. I'm sure that many of us did this, at least the Americans amongst us, where you go to the National Archives and you can see the original Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. When I was there a few summers ago, they also had one of the copies of the Magna Carta on display. I think it was on loan from Great Britain, and other important and famous foundational documents of the United States. Unfortunately, the National Archives in Israel does not have a any kind of museum or public display place like that. So they had this exhibit where they took 60 important documents, including the Megillat Atzmaut, the Israeli Declaration of Independence, which I'm sure you've all seen pictures of. Somebody post the link to it, please. It's a rather elaborate document with this blue and white cord that binds together the two different pieces of the parchment. The original Declaration of Independence, I was surprised to discover this, the original Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel has not been publicly displayed in 60 years, had not been publicly displayed in 60 years since the time it was signed, when at the Hakrazat HaMedina in on Hei Iyar, the 5th of Iyar in 1948. It's been, locked away in a vault in the National Archives. So that was on display along with 59 other significant documents. Among those documents was the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, signed by Anwar Sadat, Menachem Begin, and Jimmy Carter. And it was open to the last, because they couldn't display the whole treaty was the size of a book, so they had it open to the final page, which had the signatures of the three of them, the original signatures, and every clause in the peace treaty appeared in Hebrew, in Arabic, and in English. And this is one of the tricky things about a treaty, is particularly when it's between two nations that don't speak the same language. Well, no matter how precise the translation is going to be, there are always going to be nuances of difference between Hebrew and Arabic. And there might be cases where the difference of a word or the difference of a nuance has a practical ramification in terms of the implementation of the treaty. So the last clause in the peace treaty says, in the event of any ambiguity between the Hebrew and the Arabic versions of this document, the English version will be the Katuv Hashlishi HaMachria Bineihem. Will be the determining one to establish what the true intent and meaning of the document is. So thank you, Rafi. You posted a copy. There's that image on the right on the Wikipedia page. You can see the copy of the original Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel. So too here, the difference of a tiny word, can mean everything. And the significance here is to say that the Jews should, the rights which have been given to Jews in the individual treaty nations remain in force, or that the rights given to them by the treaty nations will remain in force. But this is a major distinction. Now, I want to point out that the sources that we're looking at tonight and this kind of textual comparison that we're doing is actually suggested by none other than the great teacher Nechama Leibovitz. Nechama, of course, was known for being a teacher of Tanakh, of Bible, but apparently at some point she also taught Jewish history. And there's a little pamphlet that she prepared about active learning in Jewish history, and it has a few different model lessons, as it were. This being one of them, and you can see, you know, the attention to detail and the text analysis that you may be familiar with from having studied Tanakh according to her method, or having read, you know, her books. So too, she brings this to bear in the Jewish history classroom. So she points out, it was published in a little pamphlet put out by Yeshiva University. It's unfortunately not really available for people to get. But she points out that there's a major distinction. Very few Jews had been granted rights by their individual states. Most of the Jews of Germany had been granted to them not by Germany, but by Napoleon, either directly or indirectly, or by the government which ruled in his name, or by his leave. By means of this small change from in the treaty nations to by the treaty nations, by means of this small change, thousands of Jews were tens of thousands of Jews were deprived of the rights of settlement, work, trade, etc. It's conceivable that only a few in each class will find the distinction. She points out that most people don't catch this. In other words, most Jews that were given rights were not given to them by Prussia or by Austria or by Bavaria or by wherever. They were given by Napoleon as he marched in. And this distinction is it. The final resolution says that the Forum of Treaty Nations will inquire how to implement, as equally as possible in all states, the improvement of the civil status of members of the Jewish faith in Germany, and how to provide them with civil rights, it's a typo, I'm sorry, civil rights to guarantee their existence on condition that they fulfill their civil obligations. So there's a recognition that, yes, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. But there's also a desire to slam on the brakes. In the meantime, however, rights which have been given to members of the Jewish faith by the treaty nations will remain in force. There were precious few rights given by the treaty nations. They were given by Napoleon, and now they're largely being revoked. One of the most interesting people at the Congress was Wilhelm von Humboldt, who lived from 1767 to 1835. Humboldt was a diplomat, a philosopher in Prussia. He was one of the founders of modern education. He was one of the founders of the Prussian educational system, which became the model for all public schooling in countries all over the world. It was very influential in the United States. Even later, the German public school model in Israel is very influential. He was the founder. There's a university in Berlin called the Humboldt University, which is named after him. He was the founder of that university. And he was a delegate to the Congress. He is notable because he kept a diary, and he wrote letters back to his wife, which shed light onto the proceedings of the Congress, and we still have these letters. So this is a letter that he writes to his wife from the Congress. He tells a story. He says, "Yesterday I declined to accept a valuable gift. From the beginning of the Congress, the Jews have tried to obtain certain civil rights in Germany. I have always expressed agreement with this matter." I mean, we know that because we saw what his objection to earlier to the original resolution. "I know, however, that you, my dear, think otherwise, but I have given the matter much thought at different times and remain firm in my opinion. Moreover, it's an idea born in my youth, as Alexander and I were regarded, whilst his brother was also well known as a his brother's also a philosopher and a scientist, a naturalist. I think he was a botanist or something like that. I'm sure you can look him up in the encyclopedia as well. He says that my brother and I, we were known as defenders of the Jews. I became even more involved on account of the fact that the Jews here in Prussia already enjoy full rights, and it's preferable then for us that these rights be granted everywhere, because otherwise all the Jews will be coming here." So he's a defender of the Jews, but he's not ready to put on a kippot and join us in shul. Let's be clear about that. In other words, he understands that there needs to be an equilibrium of rights of Jews throughout Europe. Otherwise, they're all going to congregate in Prussia, which is more liberal than other places. And we wouldn't want that, certainly. "For several weeks now, I feel that a number of those seeking the welfare of the Jews is increasing. And since Gunz is at its head, it was clarified at once. I heard with absolute certainty," let me turn the page, "that Hardenberg even signed a written commitment, but I have not been approached with any recommendation." Now here's the interesting part. Shh! "There is an old man in Prague, however, whose personality I find pleasing because he does not belong to the modern Jews, who has approached me several times to commend the matter." "I composed a resolution reflecting my views. In the current consultations, the matter has become one of the major points of discussion, not on account of lack of more important issues, but because it's almost impossible to discuss more important issues, since it's known from the outset that they are more likely to explode than to unify." Metternich was the mastermind behind the whole Congress, and these other folks that he mentions, and I supported the matter best we could. There was, of course, opposition. The issue was debated during two sessions. Metternich, as was his wont, nearly backed out, but I fought for it, found new arguments, and gave it a non-dangerous form by pushing it into the next meeting of the Treaty Forum while obtaining confirmation of those rights which the Jews have already secured. Much has been said about this issue. Everyone knows I composed the resolution and gained its approval. Yesterday, the elderly Jew came again and thanked me numerous times, offering me three rings and an emerald housing large diamonds, and added that if I did not want them, he would deposit 4,000 ducats for me in his bank. This was some kind of, it wasn't a bribe exactly, because Humboldt had already introduced the resolution, was already in favor, but it was a way of kind of, rewarding the defenders of the Jews. Humboldt says that I declined, of course, to accept them or the money, and you can imagine the man's astonishment. You cannot imagine the man's astonishment when I told him, without opposition or coquetry, that all I have done has been only for the sake of the Jews, and that I shall not accept anything in compensation. So, again, he says, "I'm doing this l'shem shamayim, for the sake of the Jews. But he's doing it for the sake of the Jews because he believes the Jews are entitled to equal rights. But he's also on record in the letter as saying that he has an interest in seeing that the rights of the Jews be equilibrialized throughout Europe, so that we don't have a lack of equilibrium, so that the Jews would all concentrate in a place like his own backyard, which would be more liberal. He doesn't want them all moving to Prussia. Save that I should call upon him for a favor should need arise. The elderly Jew will not be complacent, however, and he now suggests to order a silver table service and send it to me next year. I told Gunz, that the Jewish leader, that even in another 10 years I will accept nothing, and certainly not this. But he is so lacking any notion of doing something without such compensation that explained to me at length that he finds me an enigma, since it is no crime nor impolite, neither am I doing it as a show of arrogance to demonstrate that I accept no gifts from a Jew. He said this in all sincerity. The truth is, these are the principles by which all holders of government positions throughout the world conduct themselves. Halavai. Halavai. Do you, I don't know if you follow the news in Israel, but halavai, that all people that hold government positions would follow such principles and not accept any gifts for anything. But he says, this is what I did. I replied to him that someone who is accustomed to defending his affairs with as much passion as I am must have as a precondition a clean conscience. I know of nothing as ungracious as not being clean and pure in political affairs. Now, the letter is interesting, of course, because it sheds some light on some of the backroom pressures and dealings and et cetera of this larger question, and how it was pushed through and throughout the Congress. Again, the Jewish question at Vienna is a very, very, very minor consideration when you consider all of the topics that were being discussed and debated and fought out. For our purposes, though, of course, it's significant because of what now happens to the Jews of Europe as the 19th century progresses. This is 1815. It's about 100 years before World War I. These next 100 years are going to be eventful. And we will continue on that discussion as we proceed in our study of modern Jewish history, which will continue next week. Good night.